Hi, I'm Brian, and I'm a designer.
And I'm Joe, and I'm a designer. And guess what? Design thinking is bullshit. Or is it? We'll talk about it. Hey there, this is Joe Alterio. Welcome to the podcast. I'm here with my host, Mr. Brian Fling.
Hey, Joe.
Hey, Brian.
How's it going?
Fantastic. Here we are inside of a bunker beneath a building. What are we doing here?
So we're going to talk about design.
Why? Why are we talking about design?
Good question. Well, first, why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. My name is Joe Alterio. I am the creative director at Formidable Labs. I'm also a partner of Primer & Co. Primer Stories, which is kind of like a visual interactive consultancy as well. And I'm also, I don't know, I do comics and art.
Kick-ass illustrator.
Oh, thank you very much. You flatter me, sir.
A Webby Award winner?
Indeed. Indeed. Got one of those. I totally paid for the trophy.
Spring.
The fetishistic spring. It was like ridiculous. I was like, I am paying for that.
Nice.
I earned it.
Of course.
Yeah. And then you. Who are you?
I'm Brian Fling. I am an app and product designer.
A very good app and product designer.
I wrote a book. Mobile app or mobile design and development. I forgot the title. It's been that long. And I also teach at the University of Washington mobile app design.
And how did we meet?
That is a really good question. So there's an arts and music festival here in Seattle called Bumbershoot. I was there to see the Pixies and an event called Flatstock, where they have all the sorts of like great gig posters and whatnot. And I think adjacent to Flatstock, you had...
It was Blue Bottle Gallery.
That's right, yeah.
Yep.
You had this really amazing robot revolution.
This is back when I thought I was going to be a professional illustrator.
Yeah. but you had this amazing poster, which our mutual friend David Adams, he bought one. He carried it around to like all night to the Pixie show and everything. And then I got a card, because I didn't want to carry a poster to the rest of the day.
Right.
I got your card and contacted you, and I think I hired you 50 bucks, I think, was the first illustration I bought from you.
I think that's true. I think that's true. And then you hired me for a bunch of stuff at that company you worked for over on Queen Anne. What was the name of that stupid company?
Duango?
Yeah. And I remember being really impressed because your title was art director, I believe. And I went in and you had like all of this like influences like printed out on the wall behind you, and
like
I was like, I was like, this guy is cool. Like he had, because it wasn't just like internet stuff. It was like a mural painting. It was like that's interesting. Like you can draw different things, and it can lead to your work, and it doesn't have to necessarily be like a one for one equation. That's really interesting.
So it's funny you say that because now when I see those on like television shows, I always call them the crazy walls.
But at the time,
strings plotted around. Some sort of
red twine.
Out evil plot.
Red twine, right.
Yeah, exactly.
Circled black and white photos.
Yeah.
No. I'll tell you what. It gave me a sense that being a creative person was something that wasn't necessarily defined by a single particular pursuit, right? Like
when
I grew up, my mom for the entire time I was growing up was an illustrator, professional commercial illustrator.
Uh-huh.
My dad worked in printing. At first he was a photographer and then he was a printer. But like it seemed like siloed.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like my dad did photo stuff. My mom just drew pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And coming into that room and also kind of meeting some other people was like, oh, you can just kind of be a generalized creative person and you're using these muscles for a whole bunch of things at once.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting.
And I think that like maybe that's kind of what we're doing
with
this podcast
in a way.
Is like we're trying to kind of pull these things apart and figure out where they go back together
again.
I think so.
I mean, definitely what we want to talk about, a variety of different things. It's not like localized towards one particular thing. And I think your background in illustration and also like your family background is very different than mine, which is more
So what
like,
is your background?
App design, mobile. Okay. I've been mobile for ever.
And how did you get into mobile?
Let's
even pick that back up and say now in retrospect, like Seattle was totally like land of mobile.
Yeah.
Back before other people were doing mobile.
Yeah.
This is like 2002, something earlier, like that. 2001.
98.
So like why?
Yeah.
Why was that happening here?
Craig McCaw.
Okay.
He's like the grandfather of wireless.
Okay.
Pre-iPhone,
uh-huh.
Everyone in mobile was here in Seattle.
Okay.
We were fortunate to work with David, who's, you know, in my opinion, just a visionary when it comes to like...
I would totally agree.
He was 10 years ahead of his time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and I got into it because I taught myself design. I really wanted to be a filmmaker. And then I worked in the film industry in Portland, my hometown, for a bit. realized that a lot of people in the filmmaking industry are not the people I really want to spend time with.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. And then I was like, okay, what the hell am I going to do? And like the dot-com era was full in force.
Totally.
And so I was like, all right, I'm going to learn this stuff.
Totally.
Because there was nowhere to learn it back then.
Yep.
There was no school or
yep.
anything.
Yep.
So I taught myself. And then, yeah, David really gave me my first big break, brought me on first like real job doing that. Mm. And it just happened to be mobile. It took me like 5 years to realize that I had some sort of skill that other people didn't have. Because I was just like, it's mobile, of course.
Right, right. Okay, so we both have done this stuff for a little while now. I would like to think that we sort of know what we're talking about. Why is it important for us to get on a microphone and talk about this stuff to other people?
One of my observations, seeing younger students kind of get into their career, there's just so much scar tissue that, you know, guys like you and I have that have been doing this for a while that, you know, you just can't really read about in a blog.
Yes.
Or, and I think people have a tendency to romanticize
yep.
design and
sure.
the creative process maybe
Good
a little
God,
too
yes.
much.
Mad Men.
It's pretty painful at times. And a lot of my students are women and people of color,
yep.
people that traditionally are marginalized
sure.
in the tech community,
sure.
let alone the design community.
Definitely.
And so I'm interested in just talking about, really frankly, about kind of the trials and tribulations of being a creative in the world.
Yeah, I would echo that completely. When I was talking to my wife last night, she was like, what's your tagline for it? And if anything, it was like, I'm extremely exhausted by the kind of TED talky and misty kind of I've figured it all out nonsense
yeah.
that percolates everything, especially the tech and especially design industry. Like an array of assholes that just kind of hang out together. Especially in that, like, I figured it all out space. I'm so bored of it. And to hear working professionals talking about their successes, terrific, but also like total fuck ups and failures and times
yeah.
you don't know how to figure something out.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
that feels important to talk about in an extremely honest way
yeah.
so that when someone is deep down that hole and they can't figure it out, or, you know, God forbid they got fired, they lost a client. Like
right.
we have been there.
Right.
I have been there too.
Right.
I get it.
Right. Another big moment for me, going to the XOXO conference.
Which I have not gone to yet.
Yeah, it's an amazing event. One of the major themes there is, it's, you know, it's okay to be a creative and deal with like imposter syndrome all the time. And
usually not okay.
But people can have like millions of views and have this perception of success, but they're really struggling financially,
yes.
emotionally, with anxiety.
Yes.
Because as designers and creatives, like, our job is to put original work in front of other people.
Sure.
And have them tell us, I don't like that.
Sure.
That looks like shit.
And the data layer now on top of that, whether it's likes or views or something,
yeah.
is just horrific.
Right.
I mean, I am so glad that I did not start out this industry with that already in place. I would
yeah.
have gone off the edge. Seriously.
Yeah.
Like, no way. Like, to think that, like, people were judging me and judging my work all the time based on the number of this little number in the mm-hmm. corner with a heart next to it. Like, that is madness. That is insane.
I have to tell my students, stick with it.
Yeah.
It's going to be hard.
Yeah.
But stick
Even
with it.
Even harder than for us, is my point.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much more competition.
Yeah.
A lot of my students, they'll come to me and they'll be like, so I want to get this job. It's an entry-level job, but they say I need to have like 6 years of experience. Like, how yeah. am I going to do that?
I know. And you go on Dribbble and you go on Behance, and there's like a 17-year-old kid in Mexico who's like, oh my fucking God. Like, my
yeah.
illustrations have never been that good.
Yeah,
and
totally.
He is just cranking them out and putting a new one on Instagram every single day.
Totally.
I mean, it's remarkable.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about all that.
So we're going to talk about all that more.
Yeah.
And not bum people out too much, because it's also a fuck ton of fun.
Yeah. I think the other thing, why I wanted to do this with you, is we agree on kind of the beauty of design and definitely appreciate it, but we also disagree on a lot of things,
yes,
too.
Yes, we do.
So it's weird. I have this weird relationship with you that I sometimes feel like you are my closest brother in design, but sometimes I'm like, we have just polar opposites on things. So we'll
That's
talk
what makes
about
it fun. That's
we'll,
what makes it fun.
We'll hit record and we'll talk about this.
Definitely,
things.
Definitely.
So then let's get into
the main event?
Yeah, so we do have like a deep dive topic.
Ding, ding!
We've been alluding to it. You shared a link late one night, and then first thing in the morning, I'm drinking my coffee, and I was like, all right, I'm going to watch this video.
Okay.
And it's a few years old.
Yeah.
Right? The title is Design Thinking is Bullshit.
Yes.
It seems a little clickbaity to me.
Sure.
As I'm watching it, I'm like live blogging my view. Right. So I couldn't have disagreed with that video more.
One thing I would say that would be useful for me to hear you tell me what design thinking is, because I have my own iteration and I want to see if it compares with yours.
So design thinking is a term that is incredibly popular in not just in the design community, but outside of the design community, like Harvard Business Review and SAP and all those. They talk about this is the future of business.
Yes.
And the path to innovation comes from design thinking. And this gentleman, Joe, I'm not even going to pronounce his last name, but we're going to put a link to his. He has created this beautiful infographic that is the history of design thinking.
Oh, fantastic. That's beautiful.
And it actually starts all the way back in the 60s with Buckminster Fuller. Yeah. And so they started this concept of a lot of the things we've already talked about today, this abstract thinking and kind of zeroing in on particular ideas. Now, there is like some methodology around design thinking. There's like some steps and things. Fast forward to today. That IDEO, who's a design firm out of San Francisco, they really kind of popularized this concept of what we think of design thinking today, which is like an exercise. Or, I mean, I just think of them as workshops, where you bring in designers and non-designers into a room. You start kind of free-forming some ideas. There's some loose structure, but you kind of go where the idea takes you. You have usually some sort of goal that you want to achieve.
Sure.
And you can have a lot of different kind of approaches, vectors to it. You start to map out what that solution is.
Yep.
Design thinking can be sometimes conflated with a design by committee, where you're basically getting kind of stakeholders and you're getting junior levels together and you're doing
a charrette.
Yes. and you're basically having people that are not designers, like really not designers, telling designers what to do. And I think so design thinking can kind of fall into that trap sometimes.
Yep.
But I've had a lot of success doing design thinking workshops and being able to basically allow people to kind of see the impossible in a day or in 2 days. And so when I was watching this video,
you felt like it was an attack on the notion that you can kind of that you can help people think about things in a different way.
She was talking more about design critique. Design thinking is not more than just post-it notes.
Let me step in here.
Yes,
and
please.
Let me add a little bit more context to the design thinking thing, because I think that will help shed some light on where I'm coming at this. Design thinking, Leonard Bruce Archer and all these other dudes, it was always white dudes back in the day, unfortunately. This kind of was born out of this kind of post-World War II, post-World War I kind of like thirst for kind of automation and data, right? The notion that like the human factors are the thing that got us into these horrific wars, and only by using a sense of rigor and process sort out the kind of messiness of what is sometimes a very kind of fungible world. And that was kind of the guiding principle for the first 20 years after those two world wars. At this point in time, and so then we, you know, we get automated food and we get HCI and we get all these things. We run all the way up to that, then starts trickling down into the consumer space. So now we have the notion of IKEA, right? Which is affordable, relatively well-designed objects that you can take home and put yourself together. In some ways, it is the ultimate realization of Corbusier's kind of notion of totally approachable but kind of slightly socialist accessible design for all, right? That like the design is so important to the human mind that it should be kind of available to the at the lowest price point, even if it's made of you know, pressed cardboard or whatever. Then we take this notion that anything messy, if you really apply a set of steps or rigors, can be kind of cut down into these basic parts. And obviously, this is incredibly appealing to corporations. Because if there's one thing that corporations don't like, it's messiness. They want to be able to plan for 2, 3, 5 years ahead. They want to tell their stakeholders and shareholders that, yes, everything is going to be totally fine. So they want to be able to make things into kind of nice, neat packages, right? When Harvard Business School starts selling this idea that even this kind of, you know, those weirdos in that department down the hall where like they always kind of smelled like weed and like something mysterious is going on in there. But like they made things that people liked. I don't know how the fuck they did it, but they did something. Well, guess what? We figured out the recipe. And the recipe is these kind of Tinker Toy things that you can kind of connect together. So zoom up to here. Now this is, you know, CEO of Pepsi says that they have to roll out products on the design thinking system. Like, are you fucking kidding me? We're at this place now where I will acknowledge your critique, Natasha Jen being part of Pentagram, like the most famous design firm in the country,
right,
is talking down to everyone else and saying, like, don't get into my space, this is my space.
Right.
I agree, that's very distasteful.
Right.
That critique that Jay shared in Slack.
Our friend Jay Feinberg.
Coy Vin, I think it was the author's name was. He argued against this notion of elitism.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you're pushing back against his design thinking, it's elitism. I would argue that, and this is like my main thesis, is that Pentagram's going to be fine. They'll be fine. They'll always get clients. They'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Pepsi is always going to be fine. The people who suffer from the kind of notion that you can turn all that kind of weirdness and kind of like getting your designs cut apart and years of being in wall reviews and design crits and design school and going through those late nights and getting to where it is, mm-hmm. you don't magically become a designer because you have these six parts. It's because of all that invisible work, the glacier underneath the ocean, that is what makes a designer a designer and what makes good design. And the people that suffer from the kind of corporatization, IKEAization of design isn't Pentagram and isn't Pepsi. It's the core designers themselves, the workaday in the trenches designers whose work is devalued.
And I can absolutely see that point. I firmly believe that everyone has the capacity to be a designer.
Sure.
Now, we can talk about the definition of design.
Right.
My thinking is that when you start a design thinking workshop or you start to invite traditional non-designers like VPs and
right.
executives and
right.
you know, engineers and that sort of thing, and you start to include them into that process, which is how I think of design thinking.
Sure.
You are starting them on that path mm. of being able to have understanding mm. of who their target users are,
sure.
to have empathy around that, to explore some of those things, to be able to, I mean, taking in like an engineer, for example, and having them be in a design thinking workshop and thinking outside of the box. Because engineers have lots of great ideas, but they live in a world of structure,
right.
of science,
right.
right?
Right.
And we don't live in that world.
No.
I mean, there is some science to what we do, but we can like bend the rules a little bit.
Yeah.
Because the work that we do is inherently subjective. It's always changing. And,
yes.
you know, and that can be frustrating for some people.
Right.
I think I find it fun.
Yeah.
Right. But I think including them in that process is one of our responsibilities as designers, to bring other people along on the journey, to help people that haven't spent as much time understanding design and color and layout and
yes.
gestalt principles and you name
sure.
it, to help guide them through that process. And mm-hmm. I think the design thinking is a good exercise to start that and get them a little bit more involved.
I would totally agree. I guess my point is that I'm not necessarily arguing against the notions of design being spread far and wide, because I think that's obviously total net good, that those ideas are endemic to the craft of making something. If you spent more time being self-critical and spent more time kind of examining an object a different way or a problem a different way, that you'll think about things a different way. Totally. Mm-hmm. My quibble is the fact that it seems as though in this kind of late stage phase of how design thinking is being regarded, it's not a top level way to help CEOs think about how to appreciate the design team. It's to replace the practice of design for a problem.
I disagree. What I tell my students, right now, we have a lot of hero worship towards engineers and engineering culture. 10, 20 years from now, whose job is going to get replaced?
Right.
Engineers work in a world of rules which can easily be duplicated by any machine.
Totally.
But what we do, can that really be?
I say the same thing to younger designers all the time.
Like, yeah.
Don't worry, your job is pretty safe still.
Right, right. We constantly don't feel that way.
No. Right. But if I was a front-end engineer these days,
yeah,
hard pass.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think it's that ability to be able to take the war room that I created with all the
sure.
different examples,
yeah.
or your ability to be able to sketch out a concept mm. and be able to put that in front of someone
sure.
and for them to immediately start to see something
right.
that they only ever imagined.
Right.
Right. Our ability to put those things down on paper and be able to do that without any sort of not being too precious about it
sure.
and be able to just kind of do that 100 times,
yeah.
1,000 times.
Yeah.
That is, I think, again, our responsibility as designers to do those things to so other people can see the vision, so then we can get other voices into the design process.
I would agree with that. I would kind of broaden that out to say that the 100, the 1,000 hours that you spend getting a critique or spending all that time, I agree with you that everyone has the potential to be creative.
Mm-hmm.
This is not some kind of like special bird thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is that whether someone or not has the ability to be creative, there is a class of people in our society that have spent the time to get good at being creative.
Right, right. I had an epiphany around this, and I think it has a lot to do with, like, kind of the differences between you and I. So your background is in traditional graphic design, illustration. Yeah. My background is in 100% digital.
Right.
Natasha, from her perspective, coming from Pentagram, which is a graphic design studio, I think that when you say, let's use design thinking to figure out what our new logo is going to be.
Right.
So from a graphic design perspective, and I think to your point, I would never want to groupthink out a logo. I don't even consider myself a logo designer. So the first thing I would do is, like, hey, let's go hire Joe. Let's get an actual person that knows this to come on board, because I do digital.
Right.
I'm more user experience. I understand the technology and where that matches with the design. That when we think about design thinking, I largely am biased in thinking that that is really more of an exercise that we do over in the digital space. I also come from a filmmaking background. Yeah. It's collaborative art, right? You can't get a film done by yourself.
I see where you're coming from, and I agree with that. I can't shake the feeling that it's also, in some ways, it's a neat trick that it also happens to sideline, from a corporate perspective, the people that you need to kind of pay to solve these problems that have the experience to do it. You know what I mean? It's just like, it just so happens that it benefits the boardroom that you can kind of use this kind of WYSIWYG decision-making process that has been kind of exculcated from a practice that has been around for 500 years.
So let me tell you the technique I used to get around that.
Okay.
Because you're absolutely right. So I use kind of a bombardment strategy.
Hit them from all sides with ideas.
Right. I was dealing with something like that. I was in a workshop, and they were stuck. They had some sort of deadline, and they needed to get some sort of redesign concept over to engineering so they could make some sort of window.
Yep.
Their agency of record was just like, there's no way we'd be able to do this.
Right.
So I was like, you know, South by Southwest is like 4 weeks. A lot of great designers of all sorts of disciplines are probably going to be in Austin. What if I paid them, like, twice their day rate to just show up in Austin a week before? Could we solve this problem? I pitched the idea to the client. To my surprise, the client was like, sure. And so then suddenly I had to ask people, and like, I mean, and they're like, okay, we're buying our tickets now to Austin. I was like, wait, I haven't asked anybody to actually do this yet. So I reached out to a lot of those people. We had like 20 different designers show up. And we just workshopped out that problem. The client was there. There was times where I had to like usher the client out into the next room and then kind of keep them busy with something else. And they were doing kind of their own design thinking exercise. We started from very bare bones brief and we created this entirely new design language in under a week. Oh, Tim Van Dam was there too. He reached out to me at XOXO. He's like, when are we going to do this again? And years later, because that's how long it took. Years later, the client came back to me and they were just like, that was one of the most successful things that we've ever done. Mm. And people like Tim, design director at Abstract, incredibly talented designer, you know, coming up to me. Tim's a 10.
Right.
I'm like a, you know, 6 on a good day. Right. Like, on some
Go, man, go. Yeah. You toot your own horn.
And for him to come up to me and be like, that was awesome, when are we going to do that again? I was floored. So in my perspective, doing something kind of out of the box, bringing everybody to the table.
But I mean, so there's a couple of outstanding parts to that. A, you had a bunch of very, very talented designers that are part of a design thinking scrum.
True.
Right? Yeah. So that's not necessarily totally what I was arguing about. I was arguing about the CTO and the CFO in like a design sprint about where a menu should go.
But like, they were there and they had opinions.
Sure.
But they also were more quiet than when you have the other balance.
Sure.
Which is when you have a lot of non-creatives.
So I guess that's my point, is that you have to kind of continue to be valuing that legacy knowledge of designers. And that means that they have to be in the room. They have to be sharing honest opinions and they have to feel valued enough to actually be able to direct the outcome. Right. And I feel like that we have been doing that as a industry for years and years and years. Right. When you have to show 3 and you show 2 shitty ones, on purpose because you want them to choose the third.
Yeah.
Like, we've been doing that for years.
Yeah.
It's like social engineering around making the stupid client make the right choice.
Right.
You
right.
just have
steering
to make
them.
You just have to make sure those levers are still in place.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I guess my argument is that this system, it removes some of those levers.
I could see that. That I'm kind of assuming that for any sort of design thinking exercise, you're going to have somebody to facilitate.
Right.
Kind of understands.
Right.
Design, abstract thinking, right. creativity.
Right.
And also, I think we are also fortunate because we spent a lot of our lives not working in-house, but on the consulting side.
Very true.
And I would say for somebody working in-house to try to lead like an internal design thinking workshop,
right.
I would not recommend that. because you have to be able to tell the CEO of a company that's the worst idea.
Right.
You might use different language.
Right.
But people at higher levels come
You've
up with terrible ideas all the time. And everybody in big corporations, they have a tendency to just nod their head and be like, that's a good idea.
I mean, I guess that's a greater point to think about as well. Is feels like this notion of like this system is designed to get to the most bland, salted, fried option.
It can.
Right? Like everyone agrees on this color shirt,
right.
white. You
but
know
I
what
think
I mean?
That some process helps
yep.
with that.
Yep.
Design thinking and design by committee can easily be conflated with one another.
Yes.
If you're not doing it properly, it can easily move into you're all getting into a room for a day to hear what the CEO thinks. I mean,
right.
Most of the workshops I lead, you know, the most senior person in the room does have a tendency to kind of go
of
on
course.
For an hour or
of
two.
Course.
But I think a good facilitator knows how to come out of that and
yes.
redirect some of those things without ignoring those things. Because I also am a firm believer that everybody is right.
Yes.
So when you go into these exercises, the CEO may say something and the CTO may say something, and those two things might be different.
Right.
And then you as a designer might understand what, you know, users or customers want.
Yep.
And that might be different from those other two things.
Yes.
And they can all be right at the same time.
100%.
And your job is to turn that into some sort of artifact.
Right. Yeah.
I like to just put everybody in the boat together. And so usually what I do design
Here's one oar.
Yeah, exactly. So the last one I did, I just did little pods. And I was like, you have this problem and you have this problem. And it would be like three or four different business people, usually like an engineer or two, and then a designer in that group.
Yeah.
And it's like, by the end of the day, you need to have this.
Yeah.
And then they're all in the boat together.
Yeah.
And usually the designer is the one doing most of the rowing.
Yeah. Yeah.
They have to work it out. And then that then creates value.
Yes.
And they start to see
yes.
like, hey, we went through all these different concepts and this was the one that worked, which is what designers do all the time.
Totally.
But a lot of times because of the way we present it and because we want to show our brilliance and not all of our
fuck ups.
Yeah. Awful ideas. So once you do that, then usually they come out of it kind of like, you know, they've all kind of shared that pain a
yep.
little bit.
Yep. Yep. Well, all right. Agree to disagree.
So I don't think we've ever done one together. Like it's a workshop. We did one in Chicago.
We did one in Chicago.
That was weird.
It was good though. It was fun.
We should do one. I think it would be awesome to do like real world ones for like nonprofits and whatnot to like help figure out hard problems.
Absolutely.
And I think designers are perfectly equipped for that.
I totally agree.
So we didn't really, I don't think we really like cracked this nut. But,
no. Well, but that's what other podcast episodes are.
Thanks for listening. You can hear all of our episodes at designer.fm.
Yep. And if you ever want to email us with anything that's on your mind, you can email us at designer@designerfm.com. Thanks.